Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of naturenow@kptz.org.
Welcome to Nature Now for the third week in February. The 10-day forecast for this week shows partly cloudy until Saturday, with one astonishing day, Wednesday, forecast as mostly sunny. I hope we all looked up to bathe our faces in the rare sun rays. Now for an observation. This is from an article in the British paper The Guardian, which was published on February 12th, 2020. Do you remember the splattered windshield and car hood so covered with insect bits that scrubbing them off was hard? I do. Roads in Ohio during the 1950s provided plenty of insect strikes, which my father viewed as a personal annoyance. We could use some of that annoyance now. Research being done in Britain, Europe, Scandinavia, and Puerto Rico gathered information on insect losses. Some of these gathered data related to car coverage. In Kent, UK, insect strikes on 700 cars revealed a 50% drop since the same study with the same variables was done in 2004.
One scientist reported a recent family holiday involved a 400-mile, 700-kilometer drive across rural Australia, but he had not once had to clean the windscreen. Years ago, you had to do this constantly, he said. The causes of decline are the destruction of natural habitat, pesticides, and the impacts of the climate crisis. Light pollution has also been cited as a key bringer of insect apocalypse. Gathering data is one form of action. Attention to the losses can perhaps help people realize the declining numbers. Michael McCarthy, a British journalist, wrote a book called The Moth Snowstorm. It's worth a read for his personal observations.
And now for the sound of our mystery animal. This is a mammal you're not likely to actually hear. Hi, we are very fortunate today to have Daryl Smith back with us to talk about what I think is a really important subject, which is how do natural history students and professionals in this area learn about these animals, and how can you help there not be an animal crisis in a community? In other words, say you have a small development of some sort or another. What keeps there from being a problem? The last time you were here, you mentioned having removed a bear from the Issaquah salmon days, which I thought was memorable. But it's easy to see that the possibilities of people panicking or responding wrongly are very high with some of these animals.
Thank you for the introduction. We live in an area which is in a rural county, and we have a national park in our backyard,
a large forest.
We're surrounded by marine shoreline and environment. For those of us who like wildlife, we're much more fortunate than many, many other people. In fact, we tell folks that we live in big league nature.
And that's partly because there are animals here that a lot of people have only seen in zoos.
That's right. And Lorna and I also lived in, just to go back a little bit, we lived for 4 years in Costa Rica, and we lived in a little community which had Costa Ricans and also folks from different countries, from the U.S. and Canada and so forth. And one of the things that happened in our neighborhood was that every once in a while, a big column of army ants would come through. And for us, it was very interesting because the army ants would come in a column 4 inches wide, running as fast as a stream. I mean, there were a lot of them. And a few of them would break off, go underneath our door, walk along the lines of the tiles that we had, and then go underneath the stove in the refrigerator, eat all the spiders that file out in 20 minutes. And it was just fascinating to watch.
It's like your little team of pest management.
Well, that's right. That's right.
That's fascinating.
But we had a neighbor who called me. He said, I don't have enough bug spray. You know, we've got ants coming into the house, and there are millions of them, and Ben, what I can, but I've got to leave. So Pete was a good guy, but he wasn't the right person to live in Costa Rica, unless he was inside of the city. So Lorna and I, also since 2012, have been faculty on the Jefferson Land Trust Natural History course, and you were one
of the
students.
Which is a wonderful course.
Yes, yes. And Heather Harding and Eric Kingfisher, of course, from JLT, and David Rue are doing a wonderful job. We attract into this county a very, very interesting group of folks who've done things in their lives.
Yeah.
I just noticed when we, in all of our class areas, when we get around and talk and kind of introduce ourselves, There are people there who've walked across Vietnam and Cambodia, folks who have sailed around the world, and right. PhD botanists and mycologists and all right. kinds of things. So,
and this is a very curious group, and I think that there is a general cast of wanting to learn.
Yes, yes, and it's fascinating to us. So we're surrounded mostly by people like that. Lorna is the executive director of a nonprofit, and it's statewide. Uh-huh. So we unfortunately spend a fair amount of time away from here, but we've got plans to stay much more locally.
Is this Western Wildlife Outreach?
This is Western Wildlife Outreach. That's
right.
correct.
Which has worked all over the state and beyond.
Yes, and we have contracts for different agencies to work throughout the state. This year, mostly with the Woodland Park Zoo, doing science education to students. And
that should be fun.
Yeah, I know. It is fun. Oh, what's sharp kids? Holy cow. I wish I could have science class when I was in sixth grade. I had to wait till eighth grade, I think.
Your ability to reach people with education has never ceased, but it certainly is enhanced by some of the things you're doing now.
Yes, education and intellect in our own community at Cape George and the city of Port Townsend and Brennan and Quilcene and Hadlock. My goodness, we got some interesting people here who have done things. And we all live in the same environment, which is on the edge of the wild. If you look at an aerial, and we'll look at Cape George and your community too, where you, a little bit further on down, Beckett Point, you look at them from an aerial perspective, there is a tremendous amount of habitat, wildlife
sure
habitat,
is.
Forest. And
there are more trees than, way more trees than houses.
Yes.
Nobody has to landscape. You're just surrounded
by
these woodlands and open land too.
Yes. And furthermore, we have the beaches. And the beaches are main travel corridors for animals. And also those steep slopes that aren't sheer bluffs. That doesn't block coyotes or cougars. They love those. Farn Brooks just discovered above our marina yesterday. He called me. We're going to go look at it. But it's an interesting bed that it's got some hawk feathers in it, and it looks to be a lookout or a little day bed or night bed also for bobcats.
I think that you have probably heard me mention this before, but I had a bobcat walk right through my drain field, paying no attention to me. My cats were inside, but they saw it, and both of them completely freaked. I'm sure they thought it was the great mama of the end of the world. But this cat seemed to be so at home. That was what was interesting to me. I'd only seen them in pictures, very healthy, walking as if, well, this is a path I usually take. They walked past where the rabbits used to live, just made their way over and up the street, and I think I saw one, just the rear end of it disappearing into some woods over on the edge of Cape George.
Bobcats are becoming quite common. The macaws did a study several years ago, the Macaw Nation, and their density estimate was 5 bobcats for every cougar. Now, that wherever there are deer, there are cougars. This is not a cougar living in your backyard, because this is a cougar that covers 60 square miles or something, or a couple of cougars or whatever. That's one aspect, one of the things we've got to think about.
We not only live in a richly populated area, but it is populated with some
animals
quite that amazing predators.
Right, yeah, exactly. Right. And 15 years ago, we didn't see bobcats anywhere.
I came here 15 years ago, and I never saw one until 2 months ago.
And then several years ago, we had an initiative, a statewide initiative, that banned leg hold traps. After that, we started seeing bobcats in good-sized numbers. Lorna and I will go and talk to folks at festivals or anything else, and they'll pull out their phones and show us the bobcats in their backyards. Also bear in mind that we think of these animals as being nocturnal, but we are kind of a poor example for that because, we're diurnal, but then we sleep 8 hours a day at least, and then we're up 8 to 16 hours. Or many wild animals are sort of active in 4-hour surges. So 4 hours awake, 4 hours asleep.
Like dawn, dusk.
In the morning especially, and then the middle of the day, typically they'll bed down for a while. And bobcats are very much into that sort of schedule. Not nocturnal, not diurnal, just a combination of every. Lorna and I have bemoaning the fact that we have not seen a bobcat here because everybody else has. And we've seen them everywhere else. And we've seen cougars.
Right.
And you've also heard me talk about, because this plays into how we interact with animals, how unlikely it is that a cougar would ever attack you. In Washington State, we have now lost 2 people ever to...
Since the beginning of statehood, perhaps.
Since we've recorded time.
Okay.
Yeah, since in records.
Yeah.
1912... And just 3 years ago, 2 cougars attacks. And there have been about 8 attacks or 9 attacks. And it's the same thing with bears, except there's only been black bears. There's been 1 person killed ever, and that was in 1954. We want people to know that. The actual risk is vanishingly small, but we also want people to be situationally aware. So, for example, you would never touch a squirrel. It's the same thing. You wouldn't approach or feed or encourage these animals to live in your backyard because that is asking for some problems. Bobcats are not dangerous animals, any animal would be dangerous if you grabbed it or if you got too close to it.
Right. Or if you weren't paying attention to your 9-year-old child. So I think this is a family educational thing, too.
Any parent would not keep your kids out, you know, your 2 or 3-year-olds without watching them,
right.
Knowing where they are all the time.
And this is part of situational awareness.
Yes. And for years, when I was in graduate school at the University of Washington, I also did search and rescue work. Most young kids get into trouble when they're untended because they wander away and get lost.
They don't get it into trouble usually because an animal has picked them up by the scruff of their shirt and dragged them off.
Right. But that has happened, and you as a parent need to be situationally aware. So here we are, surrounded by wildlife. Fascinating. Almost all of the wild animals try to stay away from us, and that's a good thing. People feed birds and hummingbirds, but it's not good to feed coyote or anything
else.
Even
raccoons.
People
feed raccoons. We don't have to go there. But the thing that I would like to emphasize and have you emphasize is we want to be in this area of fascinating creatures. We don't need to try to draw them into our world.
No.
We need to maybe look while we're hiking or be out and be aware, but not to necessarily say, well, boy, if I put out half of a lamb over there, something will come and get it.
Yeah.
I can see somebody thinking like that.
Yeah, or spreading out dog food or something, or throwing out apples for deer. I love deer, too. They're fascinating animals. That can create its own set of problems. Mm-hmm. The issue that we have with deer, for example, is not just a Port Townsend issue. A couple of years ago, Lorne and I were in Republic, Washington, where everybody hunts. We had just come from Port Townsend, where you see deer on all throughout the city.
Sure.
And here in Republic, Washington, they had the same problem, except there were large mule deer everywhere. The local newspaper has a photograph of a mule deer buck trying to walk into the newsroom.
So how was this happening?
Well, people don't like to shoot bambies, and I can understand that because I don't either. And it's an issue that we need to work on as a community. Anything that a deer eats, they're welcome to, essentially, on our property.
Right.
But we also don't encourage them to come to our property. If they come to, that's fine. I think folks in general should realize that we're surrounded by these animals, and we should start a community discussion, I think, because we started one yesterday in Cape George about how to sort of get a handle on the deer issue. We are not bothered, Lorne and I, Karen and Varn and some of the others we know, we're not bothered by this. We did run into a deer, total our Volvo. And I'll mention one other thing, too, that when we give presentations, we point out that the most dangerous mammal other than humans are not large carnivores. They are deer. And that is primarily because of accidents running into them on the road.
People get killed.
Yeah, people get killed. You know, 150 or so people are killed per year in the U.S.
Everything's relative, actually.
Yeah, and 40 people are killed by elevators, as we point out, you know.
Yeah.
So
I try to stay out of elevators.
So this is an issue that we don't have an answer to right now. I bet we could come up as a community with some answers if we thought that this was important. The main issue, though, is not to feed these animals. If you have things that deer eat that you want to protect, you need to fence them out.
Mm-hmm. As far as I've known from just checking, fencing, if it's good, is the only thing that works, because you're not trying to deal with the animal. You're just trying to keep it. See you later.
Right. And also bear in mind, for example, if you look at do an aerial survey of Port Townsend, look at all the wooded area we have, look at all the travel corridors.
Mm-hmm.
We have lots of deer habitat in the town that isn't yards. We have
Chetamoca Park, places on the edge
everywhere.
Of Morgan Hill. Right.
Cappies. And these are amenities for us, too. So we share them with wildlife.
Do you feel that in the time that you've been observing, there are more cougars present, or are we noticing more? That's what I've been wondering.
Well, we're slowly densifying, and we're getting people around who actually recognize them, and we don't hunt very many cougars around here, which is actually a good thing, because that keeps the population structure older and wiser, and it's stable. I don't think so, but I don't think that we're getting larger numbers necessarily here.
Okay.
We do have an expert, Mark Elbrock, who lives in Squim. He is a real expert on cougars, and he's working with the Elwha, and they're doing cougar study right now, as are the Jamestown
Sklallam
and the Port Gamble Sklallam. We talked to a biologist who's studying elk, and of course, putting out cameras, They are all coming together, sharing their information.
Wonderful.
And we'll have a lot more information about cougars from very good people in the next year or two.
Then we'll have you back and talk about it.
Very good.
Daryl, thank you so much. This is a huge and fascinating subject, and I'm very glad that you and Lorna, as wildlife biologists, are pointing science at all these questions.
Well, thank you.
I really appreciate it.
And we work with the agency biologists, the Department of Wildlife. It's a big community. That's the way you should do things.
Of course, but not everyone does. Thank you so much, Daryl.
Thank you, Mary.
I appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Our mystery animal is the mink. You may wonder, why do we have them around here? They are related to ferrets and ermines, and they resemble them in being thin and narrow-bodied. They live near and use water. Their feet are webbed for swimming, and their fur is coated with oil. They make dens near water, often in hollow logs. They pad their dens with leaves, grass, and fur from animals they've caught. They are carnivores, hunting muskrats, chipmunks, mice, rabbits, fish, snakes, and frogs. The American mink normally only vocalizes during close encounters with other minks or predators. The sounds it emits include piercing shrieks and hisses when threatened, and muffled chuckling sounds when mating. Kits squeak repeatedly when separated from their mothers. They are solitary and active at dusk. The only report I've heard of someone seeing a mink locally was several years ago of one crossing Hastings Road toward water. Debron Kelso, Nature Now producer, reports she saw a dead mink years ago near Quilcene and has wondered why she has not seen others. They are not counted in the lists of terrestrial animals in Olympic National Park.
Regarded as intelligent, they are feral and not pet material. Unlike ferrets, which they resemble, they are seldom adopted for domestic life. One source said that although intelligent, minks are not quick to learn tricks taught to them by their owners. In spite of the waning interest in wearing fur, mink farms continue in Washington State and in around 22 other states. When released from pens in acts of so-called liberation, the farmed mink do not adapt well with wild mink and will challenge them for food supplies. Farmers consider the captive mink domesticated.
That's it for Nature Now. Thanks to Alex Henley for engineering and his words. We've enjoyed bringing you this authentic and eclectic show. Nature Now is on Wednesdays at noon and repeats Thursdays at 5:05 p.m. and Saturdays at 12:30 p.m. Over and out.
Today's outro music is Tom Pace. Maybe. Some of the more astute listeners may recognize this as the theme song from Grizzly Adams.
Take me home, take me home. baby, baby.